Hello, welcome to episode 15 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man and my name is Graham Lee. As is often the case, the topic for this episode comes from the development of the Amiga Smalltalk interpreter, and that topic is storing numbers on a computer. Now, that's a vast topic, so I'm not going to go into all of it because I realize how often I overrun on this podcast. So I'm not going to look at fractional numbers at all. I'm just going to look at integers, because there can't be too many ways to store integers on a computer, right? Well, not so much. Let's start by looking at the numerical base. A lot of early digital computers used the decimal system and stored digits between 0 and 9 in their memory. So the longest serving computer, the oldest computer that is still currently in service, which is admittedly in service in a museum, is the Harwell computer, or which, because the Harwell lab, when they decommissioned it, gave it to the Wolverhampton and Staffordshire Institute, which named it the WICH, the Wolverhampton Institute for Teaching Computing, from Harwell. Now, that uses as its memory these decatrons, which are vacuum tubes with decimal counters on them. So each unit of the memory can store and replay a number between 0 and 9. This is a common design of early computers because they were used to automate mathematical tasks, and a lot of mathematicians use the decimal system because that's the conventional numerical system for human endeavor, really. So even if computers were internally storing the numbers in binary, of which more later, a lot of early computers, this Harwell one, the ENIAC, a lot of early IBM machines, were all accessing their memory in terms of decimal digits, and so could represent numbers between 0 and 9 in each character of their memory. That's not the only system. There were early mechanical computers that used the ternary format, so you have three different states that a particular location in memory can take. And there were, in the 50s and beyond, Soviet computer systems that used an electronic form of ternary. So either a balanced system, which is what the Soviets used, where you have a minus 1 volt, 0 and 1, well, not minus 1 volt, but a minus the rail voltage signal, 0, or a positive voltage signal as your three states. The other alternative is an unbalanced ternary system where you have a 0, 1 and a 2, which can also be represented using 0 and half and 1, which is called a fractional ternary state. But obviously not a lot of people are using ternary now. You know, all modern electronic computers are based on binary, apart from quantum computers, which are based on qubits, which are still binary in their heritage. And why is this? Well, the trade-off is that using more states allows you to have, for the same computational capacity, fewer parts and a lower power consumption. You know, if I want to store, well, let's just say I want to store numbers up to 30, I've got a ternary system. That means I need four trits, because I can store three states in one trit, nine in two trits, 27 in three trits, and then 81 in four trits. So there we are. If I wanted to store numbers in up to 30 in binary, then I need five bits. So I need more components to do that. On the other hand, the electrical engineering, or the electronic engineering, of a binary system is a lot simpler, and particularly the interpreting the voltage that you read when your timer latches on to the state of the computer is a lot less error prone. Let's say that I've got a write instruction that's changing the state of a register from 0 to 1, and when my timer fires and my read electronics latch on to the state of the register, the bit in the register, it's at 0.7. In a binary system, it's pretty obvious that 0.7 is probably going to mean 1, because it's much greater than 0.5. So if you're choosing between 0 and 1, you're more likely to choose 1. In a ternary system, let's say we're using fractional ternary, so my voltages are 0, 0.5 and 1, and I read 0.7, it's maybe not clear whether that should be 0.5 or 1. And indeed, if it should be 1, because my voltage was ramping up from 0 towards 1, then I'm going to erroneously read 0.5. And so you have to have a lot slower clock, perhaps, to allow the voltage to settle on the value before you latch onto it and read it, much tighter tolerances in your components so that the voltages settle down a lot faster, which is basically the same thing, but just worded in the opposite sense. So it's cheaper and easier to build binary electronics, even though it's more power efficient and more cheaper, like more space efficient, to build electronics that use more states. And ultimately, you can get to effectively continuous voltage levels, in which case you've got analog computing, and you would treat any variance or oscillation in your signal as part of your simulation, if that's what you're doing. So analog computers are still used in various contexts, and digital computers are used in many, many more contexts and tend to all be binary. Okay, so we've settled on binary. Done, right? That's the end of the episode. Wrong, because you still get to choose how you encode numbers in the bits. The most efficient in terms of component way is to encode your numbers as binary numbers. So every bit is used, and if you've got say 2 megabits of memory in your computer, then you can store 2 to the however many that is, 2048 different states, different numbers. Of course, we tend not to work with the memory of the computer as if it represents a single number. We tend to chunk it down into what we call words, which are things of a size of the arithmetic logic units in our processors, so that they're reading batches of bits that are the size that they do maths on. But even so, if we break our 2 megabits of memory into 8-bit bytes, for example, then we would have a certain number of 8-bit chunks where each of them can store a value between 0 and 255, and we're using all of the bits in the memory to store all of the numbers. We still have the question then of, if I can build a system that uses 8-bit bytes, but then I have larger addressable numbers, larger addressable bits of the storage, which we're going to call words. Let's say I can have 4 bytes in a word. So I can read a 32-bit number from my memory in one go, even though my bytes are, my addressable units in the memory are each 8 bits long. How do I encode the number? If I store a 32-bit number in 4 bytes, where do the bits from that number end up in those 4 times 8 equals 32 bits in the memory? Or indeed, if I'm storing an 8-bit number in 8 bits, in which, you know, where does each bit in the number live in the memory? And so this is the endianness problem. And interestingly, endianness, the term, which comes from Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, and an argument over whether to eat boiled eggs from the little end or the big end, which was a like parody or a satire on religious schisms in the church, where they're basically doing the same thing. They're eating a boiled egg, but they have these intense conflicts over the appropriate way to do it, reflecting conflicts over the liturgy and over the forms of worship in the Christian church. Anyway, this term, endianness, was only introduced in an IETF document by Danny Cohen in 1980, which is surprisingly late in the history of computers, because we'd had this conflict over endianness in computing essentially since digital computers or binary computers were first introduced. So there are more than two ways to do this. There's obviously little endian, where each of the bits in your number go from the leftmost bit being the most significant, so the one that represents the largest digit, to the rightmost bit being the least significant, so representing the smallest digit, 0 or 1. And Intel does this, the IA32 architecture anyway, and the RISC-V architecture is also little endian. The opposite, big endian, is not just flipping all of the bits in the number. What it's doing is flipping all of the bytes in a word. So if I've got my 4-byte, 32-bit number, let's call it number 0123456 7, I would store the most significant byte, which is the largest two digits, 0, 1, at the rightmost end, and the one before that would be the next most significant digit, so 2, 3, and then the 4, 5 to the left of that, and the 6, 7 to the left of that. So the number would be represented in memory as 6, 7, 4, 5, 2, 3, 0, 1. Although, like, that would be kind of transparent to everyone. You would only see that if you were, like, actually, you know, using a monitor or a debugger to look at the state of the memory. So that's big endian, and the Motorola 68000 series of processors, and indeed the 6800 and the IBM Z architecture, are big endian processors. Notice that what we didn't do was, like, as I said earlier, flip all of the bits. What we did was store the bytes in a multi-byte word from least significant to most significant, rather than the bits in a number from least significant to most significant. So those appear to be the two options, but I haven't mentioned many of the CPUs that are on the market at the moment, and that is because most CPUs are actually software selectable endianness. So ARM, PowerPC, Alpha, Spark, MIPS, HP's PA RISC, and Intel's Itanium all let the software choose what endianness is used. And so on Power, you might find that Linux uses a little endian system, whereas IBM's Unix would use the big endian system. On PowerPC, if Apple's macOS uses big endian because it's ported from the Motorola 68000, but a PC emulator would switch it into little endian so that it's cheaper for it to store the PC's memory represented in the memory of the PowerPC and to work on it. Then that sounds like we've covered all three options, the little endian, the big endian, and the software defined endian. But actually, there's another one, the PDP-11, and I think one or two other machines had a system where, in translating a 32-bit floating point number into 4 bytes to store in memory, the low 2 bytes would be stored on the right, but in little endian order. So the kind of 16-bit words were little endian, and the 8-bit bytes within them were big endian, or the other way around. Anyway, it's called mixed endianness or PDP endianness, and that is essentially a weird quirk of working with monitoring the memory on exactly that one architecture. But we don't have to use all of the bits in a binary word to represent all of the bits of a binary number. What we could do is store decimal numbers using binary electronics. So this is a system called binary coded decimal, or BCD, where typically you would use 4 bits to represent a decimal digit. So you would use the numbers 0 to 9, and any of the other states that those bits can take, so 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, are erroneous and shouldn't be accessible, and if they are, then something's gone wrong with your maths. Why would you do this? By the way, as I mentioned before, early computers typically exclusively gave you access to decimal numbers as a programmer, even if they were using binary storage, like binary memory internally, as a hardware choice. And so these would be using some form of binary code decimal to store and retrieve those numbers, even though what you saw was limited to the decimal digits and values 0 to 9. So why would you do this? Well, if you're doing decimal calculations, let's say that you're working on financial software where everyone's working with decimal money, you can do this precisely because as many digits as you need, you just use more of the memory in binary coded decimal form to represent those digits. It's also linear time and simple to translate that to an output device if you want to display a decimal number. Let's say that you were driving 7-segment LCD displays like those on a pocket calculator. If you've got your number stored in binary coded decimal, then you do a linear map of each BCD digit to the output voltages you need in order to make the display look correct. And you're done. Whereas there isn't a known constant time algorithm for represententing a binary number on a decimal display. The drawbacks to binary coded decimal, one is that it uses more space, but in that for every 4 bits you're only storing 10 different states, not 16 different states. And so for a large number you need more digits. Let's say you want to store the number 1,000 or numbers of the order of magnitude of thousands in your computer. Binary coded decimal, we know that we need 4 bits per digit and 4 digits in numbers of order of thousands, so that's 16 bits. But 16 bits using binary directly can represent 65,536 different states. You only need 12 or 13 bits to represent all of the numbers up to 10,000, and then you've got some change as well. So it's not the it's not the most efficient storage. You need more electronics to store bigger numbers. But the more spacing actually turns out to have its benefits as well. In early computers, when you're using punch cards, if you're punching numbers with binary coded decimal, then the fact that there are sparser numbers means that there are going to be fewer holes across the punch card, which means it's going to be less likely to tear, and the sort of card will be sturdier. So that's no longer relevant to the way that we design computers, but was an argument in favour of BCD back in the sort of times of the Hollerith machines and the early IBM computers. Anyway, the other drawback is that your logic just for doing maths is more complex, because you have to be able to deal with multiple carry states. If I add the numbers 9 and 3 together, if I use a binary adder, then what I'll get is 12, but that's not a valid state in BCD, so I need to check how many times that carried, and then add another digit and deal with the difference in order to get the value that I want. So many computers that use binary encoded numbers directly also had hardware, had instructions for working directly with binary coded decimals. So things like the Motorola 68000, the IBM 360s, the Digital VAX, the MOS 6502, which is used in the Apple II, the Commodore 64, and a load of other popular computers in the microcomputer era. They all work directly with BCD numbers. That's a lot less common now, and indeed the modern Freescale instruction set, which is the successor to the 68000, doesn't have those BCD instructions. Other CPU types had conversion instructions, so like the x86 and x87 could convert between binary representation and BCD representation, so could the Zilog Z80 and a bunch of other CPUs. Now, this idea of needing 4 bits to represent a decimal digit and of working in decimal digits, so in multiples of 4 bits, has a legacy in that if your computer uses like 4, 8, 16, 32, 64 bit wide words and bytes, it is probably from a heritage of using binary coded decimal. You don't have to use 8-bit bytes. It's a convention, not a fundamental law of computing. So there are systems with other word lengths on the market. These were typically designed when the word length was chosen to represent text rather than numbers. So the UNIVAC series of computers and the PDPs typically used 6 bits to represent a character, so, because they're using Western languages and Latin alphabet. So your 6 bits would give you 64 characters, which is the upper and lower case, and the numbers, and then you've got like, you know, a space and one other, like a dot or whatever. So if you're using multiples of 6 bits, then you can get 6 6-bit characters in a 36-bit word, and you can buy a computer today, the ClearPath Dorado, which is a successor to the UNIVAC 2200 series of mainframe computers. You can buy that computer that has a 36-bit word length, so you know, 32 and 64 are not the only choices for word lengths available in computers that you can buy today. Does make some things a bit weird. You'd often interact with the memory in terms of octals, because octal, so the base 8 number system where you have the digits 0 to 7, you require 3 binary bits to represent an octal digit, and then you don't have redundancy like you do with BCD. So your 6-bit character could be entered as 2 3-bit octal digits. And indeed, the VAX series of computers have the ODP, the octal debugging prompt, where you can just type octal directly into the memory of the computer to set up, like the loader or to debug your program or whatever it is that you want to do, enter data and so forth. However, because of the popularity of the C programming language and the requirement in the C standard that the fundamental data type, the char, that's how I pronounce it. If you say car, then I'm sorry and you're beyond help. The char must be at least 8 bits wide. You can't address, if you're using octal, multiples of 3 bits or 6 bits, you can't address 8 bits directly. So what you tend to do is to address 9 bits, and you have 9-bit characters, and then because you had 6 6-bit characters, you had 36-bit word, you now have 4 9-bit characters, you still have a 36-bit word, you're still using your memory efficiently. So watch out that if you're making the assumption that a char in C is exactly 8 bits long, there are computers you can buy today in which that is not the case. Right, so now we must be done. Right, we've done the subject of death of storing numbers on a computer, of integers anyway. But no, because we've still got to choose how to represent negative numbers. They turn out to be quite handy in a lot of mathematical and financial applications and business and so on. So we need to define how the arithmetic instructions in our processors are going to handle something like, for example, subtracting 2 from 0 or subtracting 2 from 1 or whatever. If I've got the bits representing 1, and let's say that we're going to use binary encoding from now on, and I subtract the bits that represent 2, what sequence of bits results in what gets stored into the accumulator as a result of doing that? And how do I interpret that sequence of bits? And as you can imagine, there are multiple choices. And indeed, back in the early days of computers, there were people who had as strong an opinion on how we represent binary numbers as there are people who have strong opinions on JavaScript frameworks in 2020. So a simple one to think about anyway is just to have an extra bit that represents the sign. So you maybe have your 8-bit byte for magnitude, and then there's another sort of flag bit on the side that's 1 for negative and 0 for positive, or the other way around. But now every 8-bit byte in your memory actually needs 9 bits, ignoring error correcting memory. We just need a bigger memory, and if some of my maths, a lot of the maths in a computer is not dealing with negative numbers, because it's not actually working with numbers at all, it's just working with byte sequences and characters and storing data in the computer. If it's not using maths and not using signed numbers in its maths, then all of that additional space is wasted, because it's dedicated sign bits and you can't access it otherwise. Also, you now have two representations of zero. I have zero with the sign bit positive and zero with the sign bit negative. That turns out to be weird and needs some handling in your arithmetic logic unit. In fact, using sign bit plus magnitude numbers is the hardest logic to encapsulate in your ALU, in your hardware, because you have to do different things depending on what the sign bits of the numbers that you're operating on are. If I'm adding two numbers and they're both positive, then I just add the magnitudes together and store that. If they're both negative, then I just add the magnitudes together, store that, and make sure that the sign bit is set. But if one of them is positive and one of them is negative, whichever way around it is, I have to subtract one from the other and then work out whether it overflowed or went through positive or negative zero, and then store the result. Similarly, comparisons, you need to check the sign bit as well. So there are a lot of implementation challenges in using a sign plus magnitude representation of negative numbers, but it turned out to be quite sort of user-friendly in the early days of computing, because these sign bits shouldn't be set too often. If you're looking at like a memory dump of your whole computer, you can, you know, quickly see where your numerical data is based on where the negative signs are, and you can quickly see whether some maths has gone wrong and, you know, ended up with a negative number where you shouldn't have one, or if you've accidentally written a negative number into your instruction space, into your like program binary, for example, by like just looking at where the sign bits are set in the memory. So there were adherents of this system, and there were computers, again from IBM, where the user experience was sign plus magnitude, even though the internal representation was something different, which we'll come on to in a bit. So the registers were using a different representation, but the memory was storing sign bit plus magnitude. The most common place to see this now is actually not in a computer, but in a book, Donald Knuth's The Art of Computer Programming and the MIX theoretical computer architecture that he designed for demonstrating the algorithms in that book. The MIX computer uses external sign bit for its number storage. So the other thing to do is to not have external sign bits and to have a convention where if you are dealing with numbers and you want to treat numbers as signed, then you take a bit from the magnitude and you use that as the sign bit, and you interpret the rest of the bits in the word or in the byte based on what you see in that sign bit. And there are two different ways to do this as well. So one is called one's complement. Let's invent an architecture that has a 4-bit word. So the positive numbers are all represented by numbers where the most significant bit is 0 and the subsequent 3 bits represent the magnitude of the number. So 0 is all zeros. 1 is 0001. 2 is 0010, and so on up to plus 7. Now, if I want to take a negative number and represent that in this system, then what I do is set the high bit to 1, which indicates that the rest of the number is negative, and then just swap all of the 1s and 0s in the number, which means that like minus 1 would be represented by 1110 in this 4-bit system. But it also means that there's a minus 0, because there's the bit pattern 1111, which is negative because the leading bit is set, and is 0 because if you flip all of the bits of the remaining the magnitude of the number, then it's 0. And so that means that there's a little bit of extra complexity across the boundary. When you no longer have the problem that you have to work out what you're doing before you add and subtract numbers, because if you add, given that the bits are flipped, if you add a number to a negative number, you're effectively decrementing the magnitude of the number, which is correct. Like adding 1 to minus 2 gives you minus 1. However, adding 1 to minus 1 would give you minus 0, which is correct because minus 1 plus 1 is 0. But then adding 2 to minus 1 would give you plus 0, because if you take the bit pattern 1111 and then add another 1 to it, you end up with all zeros in your word, and then the carry bit is set. So arithmetic on one's complement numbers needs to pay attention to that case. And if you cross 0 and negative 0 and you end up with a carry bit, you have to add 1 again in order to get the correct answer. Yes, there were computers that really use one's complement arithmetic. The ones I described earlier, where the memory is stored as sign plus magnitude, but the registers used an inline sign bit, those use one's complement encoding. Also, that weird ClearPath Dorado, the UNIVAC 2200, is one's complement computer. So you can actually buy a computer with one's complement arithmetic. But it's not the most common implementation of negative numbers on digital computers. That would be 2's complement, which is what's used on pretty much any personal computer architecture you can buy today, pretty much any server architecture, and also on the Amiga and in Amiga Smalltalk. 2's complement is the easiest to implement in hardware, which is why everybody does it. So again, what we're doing is borrowing a bit from the magnitude to represent the sign bit if we're dealing with signed numbers. But now we represent negative numbers by flipping all of the bits as in one's complement, but then adding 1. This is still a reversible operation. So minus 1, if we've got this 4-bit representation, then the representation of 1 is 0, 0, 0, 1. If we flip all those bits, we get 1, 1, 1, 0. Add 1, we get 1, 1, 1, 1. So all 1s is the representation of minus 1 in 2's complement. Now, if I do that operation again, flip all of the bits and add 1, and I get to 0, 0, 0, 0, add 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, which means I'm back where I started. So just like the 1's complement thing, this is a reversible operation. The 2's complement of a negative number is its positive magnitude. However, there is now only one representation of 0, which is all zeros. If we take the 2's complement of 0, then we would get 1, 1, 1, 1, add 0 to that. Add 1 to that, and we've got all zeros again, and presumably the carry bit has been set. Now that means that there's no special cases in the arithmetic. If you just ignore overflow when the number passes through zero, when the result passes through zero, then you get the correct answer. And the comparison case, which we talked about in terms of the sign plus magnitude implementation, is also a simpler case, because all you need to do is subtract the two numbers and then see whether the difference is greater than zero or less than zero. And you then know whether the two numbers were in ascending or descending order. And of course, if the difference is equal to zero, then you know that they were identical. So that is the common form of representing negative numbers on computers that are available today. And this came up in the context of Amiga Smalltalk, because we use 16-bit words in Smalltalk, which is what the Smalltalk 80 implementation did, both as numbers and as pointers. But there's a tagged pointer, so it's possible to store an integer in a pointer in line just by using the top 15 bits of the pointer word as the integer value and then setting the last bit to 1, because all of the pointers have to be on even numbered addresses. So what we were getting wrong was thinking that what we could do is take our number, shift it left by 1 bit, and then add 1, and that gives us our pointer representation, and then shift it right by one bit and get back to the integer value. And that's not true, because we need to know whether the number was positive or negative and set the sign bit at the left-hand end. Once we've done the right shift, we need to know whether the most significant bit, which of course we've lost because we did the shift in the first place, whether that should be 0 or 1. So the convention you have to follow is that you can only store a 15-bit signed integer. So you've got 14 bits of magnitude and a signed bit on the most significant bit. Then you shift your pointer to get the integer value, and if the most significant bit of the pointer was high, then you set the most significant bit again after you've done the shift, and that means that the sign bit is negative, and so the number is treated as a negative number. It doesn't change the magnitude and you get everything right. But working out that this was something that needed to happen required going through this understanding of how the negative numbers were represented, which of course is something that, you know, it's easy to know once you've been taught it, but there's no particular motivation for teaching it in modern programming contexts where we're using fairly abstract computational machines that don't really have any bearing, any relation to the physical computer that we're running them on. The only reason that I knew about this two's complement stuff was from working with machine language on 8-bit microcomputers from decades ago. It wasn't something that had come up in the context of like professional computing. We still haven't done every possible way of representing negative numbers on a computer, or indeed binary numbers at all, because the 2's complement is essentially a special case of what's called like offset binary or excess binary, where we say that there's some initial value, call it n, and that a number stored in a word in memory represents n plus the value of the binary digits. And in the case of 2's complement, it's like 2 to the minus number of bits. But you could just say, and indeed this was used often in correlation of binary coded decimal, you could just say that n is 3 or n is minus 3. So if you have n is minus 3, then your 4-bit word that goes from 0 to 15 in a normal binary representation actually goes from minus 3 to 12 in this excess 3 representation. And then you store your binary coded decimal within that context. That again is one that has historical use and has use in the IEEE floating point and decimal standards, but isn't generally used in like everyday integer arithmetic in the like arithmetic logic units in a computer. Anyway, that is storing numbers in a computer. The short version that only considers integers, and we're already twice as long as one of my usual episodes. I hope that you've enjoyed this episode. Please do give me any feedback, GrahamLee@acm.org or Twitter, IwasLeeG, IwasLeeG. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you again next time.